Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourselves up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marches never changed anything.
Out.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and he was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, no, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Okay, it's time for another installment of It's My House. And today, our live stream is titled Generational Wealth, the Ultimate Reparations. We're going to take a look at a family and an additional individual not in this family. We're going to take a look at the Toyota family. Toyota is it's a family business. And they're Japanese, in case you didn't know. But they've got a very interesting story that I believe anybody can model. So we're going to play some videos, some audios by them, that is. And but before we go into that, just a teeny bit more of morning motivation.
Hirichiro Toyota was born in 1894 as the eldest son of Sakichi Toyota, who was famous for inventing the automatic loom. When he went to the U.S. for the first time in 1921, Hirichiro was astonished by the prevalence of automobiles and expected the era of the automobile would soon come to Japan. In 1929, he visited Detroit and toured automobile factories, which became his inspiration to manufacture passenger cars in Japan. In 1933, Hirichiro convinced the people around him to establish an automobile department inside his father's loom company. Hirichiro and his colleagues began by tearing down an American vehicle to understand each component one by one. There were many hurdles and hardships because neither the industrial base nor the technological capabilities for making automobiles existed in Japan. Still, Hirichiro and his team pursued their dream of making Japanese passenger cars with passion and determination. In 1936, after going through a number of trials and failures, he finally completed the first passenger car, the Toyota Model AA. The following year, the automobile department became Toyota Motor Corporation. In the beginning, Toyota's vehicle frequently broke down, leaving the customer stranded. Hirichiro would rush to the point of the problem, or Gemba, and repaired the vehicle himself. He would take the defective parts back to the company to analyze the cause and make improvements. With his philosophy of customer first and Genchi Genbutsu, which means go and see, to understand what is happening, Hirichiro and his team devoted themselves to improving the quality of their vehicles. Hirichiro also introduced the just-in-time approach in manufacturing to eliminate waste and promote continuous cost reduction. This later evolved into the Toyota Production System, and together with Kaizen, became the symbol of Toyota's way of making cars. After the war, Hirichiro restarted the development of cars in 1947, but he soon had to resign as president in 1950 after the company faced a financial crisis. In 1952, just as he was about to lead the company again, Hirichiro passed away at the age of 57. It was only 3 years later, in 1955, that the first mass-produced passenger vehicle he had worked so hard to develop, the Toyopet Crown, was introduced in Japan. Toyota soon started exporting its cars and introduced other core models such as the Corolla and Camry, which are still being produced around the world today. The Japanese startup Hirichiro established more than 80 years ago has become a global automobile company. As of 2018, Toyota makes cars in 27 countries and regions and sells over 10 million vehicles in more than 170 countries and regions. Leading Toyota now is Akio Toyota, a grandson of Hirichiro.
This little speed demon is called the Supra. The Supra is a two-seat sports car stuffed with BMW parts that can go from a complete standstill to 60 miles per hour in an estimated 4.1 seconds. And it is, of all things, a Toyota. The car just began rolling out to dealerships in July of 2019, and it's another step in Toyota's strategy to inject excitement back into its brand. The Supra is a revival. First produced in the late 1970s, the nameplate gained fame as a high-performance car in the 1990s and is still regarded as something of an archetypal Japanese sports car. It was made famous in part by its prominent role in the Fast and Furious movie franchise. The massive Japanese automaker brought back the classic Supra name for the 2020 model year and aimed it at fans around the world eager for a double dose of sports car nostalgia and speed. But while the Supra has generated a lot of attention, the truth is that Toyota is far better known to most people as the maker of cars like this. This is the Toyota Corolla, the best-selling vehicle of all time. Toyota has become one of the world's largest automakers by churning out cars, trucks, and sport utilities like this. Affordable, reliable, and safe. But over the years, it has also grown a reputation for being kind of boring. A scion of the Toyota family, Akio Toyota, now has the reins at the company founded by his ancestors. And he has given the company a severe order. No more boring cars. Now, the Japanese giant is doubling down on speed, adventure, and cutting-edge technology in a bid to survive and succeed in an era where global automakers face tremendous uncertainty over the future. Toyota is hoping it can imbue its vehicles with passion and excitement while preserving the legacy of high quality and affordability it has spent the better part of a century perfecting. Toyota Motor was founded in 1937 by Kiichiro Toyota, the son of the famed Japanese inventor and industrialist Sakichi Toyota, who made his fortune building looms for weaving fabric. The business became especially successful after the outbreak of World War I, which gave a boost to the Japanese cotton industry. But the end of World War I led to a downturn in the Japanese cotton and fabric businesses that was worsened by the Great Kanto Earthquake of 1923, the Financial Panic of 1927, and the Worldwide Depression in 1929. On the other hand, the earthquake created a massive demand for cars. The disaster had devastated the Japanese rail system, and the country began importing chassis from Ford Motor Company to convert into buses for public transport. Toyota created the Automotive Production Division of Toyota Automatic Loom Works on September 1, 1933, and soon after began plans to build a manufacturing facility. He had absolutely no experience making automobiles. So he purchased vehicles from Ford, Chevrolet, and Chrysler and took them apart, looking for models on which he could base his own design. He also recruited engineers from Japanese car companies and local subsidiaries of American car makers such as GM. The company's first production passenger car, the Model AA, was launched in 1936, and a separate company, Toyota Motor, was formed the next year. Soon, though, Japan was embroiled in World War II, and the country's auto industry shifted production to help with the war effort. The war left Toyota a battered company. Production was tightly restricted, materials were in short supply, and one of its factories had been bombed at the war's end. In its aftermath, though, Toyota began making the trucks the company believed Japan would need to rebuild itself. Toyota also got a big break in 1950 when the U.S. Army placed a large order for trucks needed in the Korean War. Toyota almost doubled monthly production from 650 vehicles to 1,000 vehicles. Slowly, Toyota remade itself, but it realized it had to expand beyond Japan if it wanted to survive and grow over the long term. And to do that, the automaker looked to the massive and fast-growing market in the United States. The cars 1950s America is best known for are massive vehicles, such as the 1957 Chevrolet Bel Air and the 1958 Ford Fairlane Skyliner. But Toyota executives noticed sales of compact cars were growing, and just about all of them were European. The company figured there was an opportunity for its own relatively small vehicle, the Toyopet Crown. A sales office was opened in a former Rambler dealership in Southern California. But the Toyopet Crown was a flop, and Toyota's newly hired American staff saw the disaster coming. The first problem was that the Crown was built to drive at low speeds over Japan's shoddy roads. But the car was ill-suited to U.S. roads, which were smooth and new, and where cars could reach highway speeds of 60 miles per hour. Toyota sold 287 Crowns in 1958. Sales tripled in 1959, but the company soon pulled the car from the market and regrouped. Toyota was serious about understanding the U.S. market, though, and began to design cars specifically for U.S. buyers. And it worked. By 1967, Toyota was the third best-selling import brand in the United States. In 1973, it set up a design studio in Southern California called Culti Design Research to develop vehicles that best suited the tastes of the American market. Today, that group has two offices. The Newport Beach, California studio focuses on concept designs and advanced designs, while the Ann Arbor office does designs for production vehicles. Toyota also received a leg up in the U.S. auto market thanks to the oil crisis of the mid-1970s, which left customers scrambling to find fuel-efficient vehicles. In 1975, the company gained the top spot among import brands. In 1986, it was the first import brand to sell 1 million vehicles in the U.S. And since then, it has remained among the top sellers. So, how did it get there? Their cars did not have the flair or pedigree of their American and European competitors, but Toyota and other Japanese manufacturers offered something different: quality and reliability at low prices.
I mean, they hit the market at the perfect time because clearly we had the oil crisis at that time. The U.S. automakers weren't producing really the small cars, and here comes the Japanese with a high-quality, reasonably priced product with excellent fuel economy.
Crucial to achieving this was Toyota's approach to manufacturing, which has become renowned throughout the automotive industry and the larger world of manufacturing. From the very beginning, Toyota stressed the importance of efficiency in its factories. Plants were set up to emit waste and inconsistency as much as possible. One thing this does is reduce wasted parts. By only keeping a small number of parts on hand at any given time and only making what is needed, the factory is liable to waste a lot less time, energy, and materials if it discovers a defect in something. Consistency and reliability became the keys to Toyota's strength. And as the automaker's sales grew, the Toyota production system became perhaps the most respected in the world.
We never believe we're the best at anything. You know, I appreciate our competitors and others thinking that we're great. You know, it's nice to be thought of as great. We constantly wake up in the morning and think, you know, we're not that great. We need to get better, continuous improvement. So that's factor one. Factor two is respect for people. And the reason why that plays into the Toyota production system is when you look at how we operate at our plant, we actually empower the team member on the line to make critical decisions about the quality of the product coming off that line.
In fact, other automotive manufacturers have tried to copy Toyota techniques to improve their own vehicles. General Motors set up a joint manufacturing venture with Toyota called New United Motor Manufacturing, or NUMMI. Even elite European car makers have wanted to learn from Toyota. Porsche brought retired Toyota executives in to teach the company manufacturing techniques when Porsche was trying to make its own lower-cost Boxster car. However, Toyota's reputation for durability has not always been flawless. Beginning in 2009, the company suffered perhaps its worst recall scandal in its history. An off-duty California highway patrolman was driving on a highway with his family when the Lexus they were in unexpectedly accelerated, crashed into another car, then tumbled off the highway and caught fire. Everyone in the car was killed. That was the beginning of a long drama that would result in the company recalling millions of vehicles and paying out more than $1 billion in a settlement with the U.S. government. Like many automakers, Toyota was also swept up in the scandal over faulty airbags installed by the Japanese supplier Takata. But if Toyota faces an enduring challenge today, it is not a perception that its products are unsafe. It is a perception that its products don't particularly excite people. At least in the U.S., auto sales have hovered near record levels in recent years, but industry observers expect sales to turn downward in the future. The other threat facing Toyota, and indeed all automakers, is the excitement over self-driving cars and competition from other forms of transportation. Cash-rich tech companies have thrown their weight behind a plethora of new transportation concepts, including ride-hailing, and apps that allow customers to quickly rent electric scooters and bicycles. Most of these concepts are still in their infancy, but they are rapidly attracting investment. Legacy automakers do not want to be left behind. To be fair to Toyota, it has been responsible for more than a few innovations in its long history. In 1997, Toyota launched the hybrid car market with the Prius, the first production hybrid vehicle. Toyota is also credited with creating one of the earliest examples of what we now think of as a crossover. The Toyota RAV4 was one of the first SUV-like vehicles built with a unibody frame typically used for cars. Crossovers and SUVs now make up 48% of the U.S. new car market, and smaller crossovers, such as the RAV4, are some of the best-selling and fastest-growing segments. But now, like its competitors, Toyota is trying to transition from a traditional car maker into a diverse mobility business. The company invested $600 million in Didi, a Chinese ride-hailing app similar to Uber and Lyft in the United States in early 2019. About a year after making a $500 million investment in Uber. The company also has a number of organizations that are devoted to researching new technologies. Toyota Research Institute was founded in 2015. It studies robotics and artificial intelligence and is, among other things, trying to build a car that is incapable of crashing. Toyota AI Ventures, the venture arm of the institute, manages more than $200 million and invests in an array of mobility technologies in areas such as robotics, artificial intelligence, and aviation. In the meantime, Toyota is trying to make bold cars that are not just practical, safe, and reliable. Current president Akio Toyoda is known to be passionate about cars in a way that is distinct from his predecessors. Akio is a driver and is fond of racing cars under a pseudonym. Notably, he test drove the Supra himself. The Supra is also the first car in the United States to be released under Toyota's Gazoo Racing sub-brand, a new line of vehicles meant to help fulfill Akio Toyoda's No More Boring Cars mandate.
I think it all kind of starts with the No More Boring Cars mantra, really. It kind of embodies that for Toyota. And I think, you know, when you add that to some of the other things that we're doing around adding some other models to our car lineup, it really lifts up the Supra idea as something for all of us to look at and say, wow, how can we inject some more life into some of our cars? And so so I think overall what it does is it brings emotion back to our brand.
Apart from the Supra, Toyota is trying to infuse excitement into much of its lineup, even in models typically known as family haulers or ride-hailing workhorses. Notably, the automaker is expanding its Toyota Racing Development, or TRD, sub-brand. Historically, Toyota has stuck the TRD badge mostly on its pickups, such as the Tacoma, the Tundra, and the 4Runner SUV. But in 2018, Toyota came out with TRD versions of the Avalon and Camry sedans. The move shocked the automotive press. For now, moves like this may help keep drivers interested in owning a Toyota, despite fierce competition from fellow automakers and a bevy of new transportation options. Toyota made itself into one of the world's biggest and most respected automakers, using innovation and discipline to leapfrog American and European rivals. The next several decades might reveal whether that will still matter.
All right, today's podcast is titled Generational Wealth, the Ultimate Reparation, 619-768-2945. I'm approaching the topic, I guess the complex topic of reparations, in a different way today. I'm using the Japanese, a couple of, primarily one Japanese family. I'm going to highlight on another person who's also Japanese, and partly of the Japanese culture. If you go to our Blog Talk, if you're online, if you go to our Blog Talk scrolling marquee today, you're going to see pictures of four people, all with the last name of Toyota. People are Sakichi Toyota, who was a farmer and a much sought after carpenter. Then his son, Kichirio Toyota, who is the founder of Toyota Motors. And matter of fact, let me go back to his father, Sakichi Toyota. He's the founder of, I guess you would say, the Toyota Group. And Toyota is a family-owned business. In any event, Criterio Toyota, he had a son. And then there's an uncle in there also that was the president of Toyota. And then the current the current president of Toyota is Akio, hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly, Toyota, who was the great-grandson of these Toyota family businesses. Now, the grandfather started off, he was a farmer and a carpenter. That was his stick. Then I think one of them got into the, they used to make these machines that were, you know, for fabric. And Couturio, within the framework, started another division, which started making the cars. Now, these are all Japanese people. Like, say, Toyota is a family. About three or four generations in now. Now, let's take a quick look. I'm just do a real quick scope at the Japanese culture, because you've heard me say many times before, everybody's been shit on. Japanese culture, they've had their slave periods too. Matter of fact, let me read about a little bit about this. These are not my words. I'm reading this online. The enslavement of Japanese people. After the Portuguese first made contact with Japan in 1543, a large-scale slave development in which Portuguese purchased Japanese as slaves. I didn't say Africans as slaves. The Portuguese purchased Japanese as slaves in Japan and sold them to various locations overseas, mostly in the Portuguese colonized regions of Asia, such as in southern China, Goa, and including Argentina and Portugal itself, until it was formally outlawed in 1595. Many documents mention that the large slave trade, along with protests against enslavement of the Japanese. Although the actual number of slaves is debated, the proportions of the numbers of slaves tends to be exaggerated by some Japanese historians, as several hundred Japanese people were sold. Some of them were prisoners of war sold by their captors. Others were sold by their feudal lords, and others were sold by their families to escape poverty. Same shit that happened in Africa, same shit that happened in Japan. That's me speaking, not the article. Let me go back to the article. The Japanese slaves were believed to be the first nation to end up in Europe. The Portuguese purchased a number of Japanese slave girls to bring them to Portugal for sexual purposes, as noted by the church in 1555. Japanese slave women were sometimes sold as concubines to Asians or African crew members, along with their European counterparts serving on the Portuguese ships trading in Japan. And there's quite a bit more to this. We can get into World War II on this. Japanese slavery also occurred during World War II. And we'll do a dedicated live stream on this here in the very near future. But the reason why I'm bringing this up is, number one, the Japanese, Japan, they've been shit on like everybody else on the planet. Number two, part of that shitting on was they had periods of slavery in their country, including relatively, I mean, World War II, sort of contemporary history. Number three, we all know about Pearl Harbor and Japanese Americans getting interred over here in the United States. So they've had their pile of shit and bowls of shit just like everybody else. Now, the Toyota family, starting off with the farmer who started the whole kit and caboodle going. I'm just going out there in L.A. fashion. Whatever hardships that his country experienced or he experienced or his family experienced, he made a decision of the buck stops here. Meaning, no matter what happens to anybody else, no matter whatever happens to Japan, the buck stops here and it starts here. Like I said, he was, and I consider that the first step in ultimate reparations. He didn't wait on the government. He didn't wait on his check. He didn't wait on any entitlement programs. He didn't wait on the government. The buck stopped and started with him, Sakachi Toyota. He was a farmer and a carpenter, taught his son carpentry, Katerio Toyota. And it was through his father's business that he started Toyota Motors. He started that company within the family business. There's another, and we're going to do a dedicated podcast to him one day, Soichiro Honda. And we've all heard of Honda. He was born in 1906, passed away with sunset August 5th, 1991. Honda, Soichiro Honda, the founder of Honda, used to work for Toyota. Honda started in a wooden shack manufacturing bicycle motors. So the Honda family is opposed to the Toyota family. And like I stated earlier, the great-grandson of Toyota, the founder, is still in business today. All right, let's go back to the
office. Hi, I'm Paul Akers, and I'm at the Toyota Techno Museum in Nagoya, Japan. And this is the machine that Sakichi Toyota first improved for his mother to make her life easier. What you're about ready to watch is the story of Sakichi Toyota. It is one of the most fascinating and beautiful stories I've ever heard, because Sakichi Toyota, the founder of Toyota, his purpose was to help people. So watch this story about him and you will be inspired. He is my hero. Hopefully you're really going to enjoy it.
In a poor village near Lake Hamano, a young man's dreams begin to take shape. He has discovered his purpose in life. He has decided to contribute to the development of his country. Recently, patent regulations have been officially introduced, encouraging creativity and protecting inventors. The young man dreams that one day he too will become an inventor. At only 18 years of age, he is unaware that in later years, he will develop automatic looms for which he will be honored as one of the world's greatest inventors. Takichi Toyoda is at a turning point in his life. He begins to spend every waking moment working on his inventions. Takichi Toyoda devoted 40 years of his life to his inventions. Over the years, he was awarded 84 patents and developed 35 utility models. By continually improving his looms, he developed 7 major models. One of them attained such a high level of performance that it was regarded by many as impossible to improve, the G model automatic loom. Takichi Toyoda, the eldest son of a carpenter, was born on February 14, 1867, in the village of Yamaguchi, now known as Kosai City, which is located 230 kilometers southeast of Tokyo. The Toyoda family was very poor. Takichi and his younger brother even had to share the same textbooks at school. At the age of 11, after completing primary school, Takichi began helping with his father's carpentry business. He was a curious boy, and whenever he had a spare moment, he would read every newspaper and magazine he could get his hands on. Takichi was inspired by the image of Japan going through dramatic changes, the overthrow of the shogunate, the restoration of the Meiji Emperor, and the rebuilding of political and economic systems modeled on advanced Western nations. He dearly loved his country and often thought about the role he might play in its development. At night, he and other ambitious boys gathered in the village hall to study together. It was then that Takichi came across a book that was to change his life. Samuel Smiles, Self-Help, an anthology of more than 300 true stories of Westerners who had pursued their own ideals. Takichi was especially drawn to the story of Richard Arkwright, a carpenter like himself, who had devoted his life to improving the loom. As he read Arkwright's work, Takichi was struck when he came upon the word invention. Invention. The word stayed in his mind. Takichi had inspiration, but what could he invent? With so little education, how was he to find a worthwhile project? Still, his dream of helping people continued to grow. In the region where Takichi grew up, weaving cotton fabric was a typical side business for many families. The looms they used required both hands to operate. This laborious task was so inefficient that for all their hard work, weavers could only earn a few pennies a day. That's it, Sakichi said to himself. I'll invent a new loom to make weaving easier for my mother. Surely it would help many others as well. That would be wonderful. But the villagers often spoke unkindly of young Sakichi behind his back. Look at him weaving away. What a funny thing for a boy to be doing. Sakichi doesn't do any real work. Do you suppose he's a bit touched in the head? It was very difficult for Sakichi, but when he felt depressed, he would listen to this sound. Sakichi's heart would go out to his mother. This would give him the courage and strength he needed to continue his efforts to improve the loom. I'll show them. I'll invent a wonderful loom. It'll be a valuable invention that will help so many people. In 1890, Sakichi toured the Japan Industrial Exhibition in Tokyo. He was fascinated and returned time and time again. The Western machines were clearly superior to those of Japan. Sakichi couldn't tolerate this. Somehow, he promised himself, I will build a great loom for my country. Day in and day out, Sakichi was completely devoted to his first invention. When flying a kite, his only pastime, his mind would wander to thoughts of his project. Even with the most modern loom, the weaver had to use both hands, one to throw the shuttle and the other to work the reed. Isn't there an easier way? Can't it be done with just one hand? Pull the reed and throw the shuttle. Pull the reed and throw the shuttle. That's it. I've got it. In May 1891, Sakichi Toyoda was awarded his first patent. His invention, later called Toyota's wooden hand loom, raised efficiency by 50% with constantly high quality. It was very well received by the public. Have been poor, estranged from others, and oppressed. But even after suffering many deprivations, a true inventor will succeed in achieving his goal. My experiences may not have been so bad, but I have certainly shed many tears to get this far. Those who dedicate themselves to invention must endure all of this. After 6 years of struggling to invent a power loom, at the age of 30, Sakichi married. With the support of his loving wife Asako, he diligently continued his work. His perseverance was rewarded with his invention of Japan's first power loom. His reputation as Sakichi the inventor soon spread far and wide. In 1897, the Okawa Cotton Textile Company was founded based on his invention. Sakichi, however, continued to devote himself to his dream by concentrating his time on developing better automatic looms. Every morning, he was up and working so early that not even his family knew if he ever went to sleep. But Sakichi's new colleagues began pressuring him, demanding to know why he was throwing himself into research instead of watching over business. Sakichi's conscience wouldn't allow him to market a product until it had been perfected. This always got him into trouble with his profit-minded colleagues. Since childhood, his single-minded desire to help society forced him to endure the hardships of an inventor. Now ostracized by his partners for his ideas and feeling betrayed, Sakichi turned his back on Japan. In 1910, he sailed from Yokohama for the United States. His memory would not let him escape from the harsh words of his former colleagues. Don't ever set foot in this company again. The vast North American continent unfolded before his eyes, filling his heart with new hope. He visited New York, Boston, and many other cities, studying American-made automatic movies. They're slow. The mechanisms are too complicated, and they break down all the time. The vibration is terrible, and the threads break easily too. These looms are nothing to be afraid of. I won't give up. Sakichi's newfound confidence led to a change of heart, and he decided to return to his homeland. I'll start all over again, on my own. In his journal, Sakichi wrote the following. Personal disgrace is trivial when compared to the enormous debt a man owes his native land. This great man put the needs of his country above himself. In January 1911, Sakichi returned to Japan. The evidence of his burning devotion to invention is still clear today. The M model power loom, which he invented in 1914, is still in use. In 1924, after years of dedicated effort, Sakichi Toyota perfected the G model automatic loom, the finest of all. It performs smooth automatic shuttle changes while operating at high speed, setting a new world standard.
This automatic loom is the finest in the world. Won't you consider giving Fat Brothers a license?
At that time, the Platt Brothers, a British loom manufacturer, led the world's weaving industry. In 1929, Platt acknowledged the superiority of Sakichi's machine. He had come a long way since when, at the age of 23, he had been ashamed by the inferiority of the Japanese machines displayed at the Japan Industrial Exhibition. It had been a long, hard journey, but at last, he was rewarded for all his efforts. After perfecting the G model automatic loom, Sakichi went on to develop a completely new concept, the circular loom. Bold new ideas like this were part of Sakichi's ability to stay ahead of the times. On October the 30th, 1930, at 63 years of age, Sakichi Toyoda's life ended, but his tireless creative spirit lives on.
に刺して一番大切な顔のことですから、日を沈め、心落ち着けて取り掛かりました。これはまた、いかなることか、すらすらと思うまま、手が動いて、わずか一日でほぼ似顔ができ上がりました。障子を開けてみよう。外は広いぞ。
A single thread from breaking, Sakichi Toyota changed the world. Be inspired. Set a seemingly impossible goal. Go out and change the world.
All right. Today we're talking about generational wealth. The ultimate reparations. Like I mentioned earlier, if you go to our scrolling marquee on Blog Talk Radio, I have a picture of four individuals, all Japanese, all blood relatives. And, well, let me Let me get your names for you. All right, the one that you heard mostly about in this last audio, Sakichi Toyota, who was a farmer and a carpenter, and essentially started the Toyota family business. Toyota is a family business. His son, Kichiro Toyota, within the family business, which was they had loom, what they call looms that they made for fabric. Within that company, his son, Kichiro Toyota, started Toyota Motors. And you know what's interesting about this also, like I said, I read something earlier in the podcast today that matter of fact, you can look it up on Yum. Slavery in Japan. Slavery did exist in Japan. There are a few periods of slavery in Japan. So despite all, you know, the backstory and all this other stuff, here's this guy, because essentially he was a hobbyist. We call him inventors today, but essentially he was a hobbyist. Anyway, we're getting to his son, Kichiro Toyota, who within the family business started what we know today as Toyota Motors. Okay. Now, mind you, let me give you more of the backstory. At one time, Japan and China, economically speaking, they were getting their ass kicked. One of the things, and there's a huge history to this stuff. We can't cover it on one podcast. But they got a hold of an American car. They bought an American car, and they broke it down part by part. Learned about every part and how to build cars by buying a car, because they didn't know how to put together a car. Toyota didn't know anything about that. They bought a car, broke it down, and learned about building cars, starting with something that, well, I call simple or elementary. They had another uncle. He ran the company for a number of years. And then the great-grandson, Akio Toyota, who's 65 years old right now, he runs the company today, which his great-grandfather, or great-great-grandfather, one of the greats, started. Now, with the backdrop of wars in Japan, with the backdrop of slavery in Japan, operations, which was started by Sakichi Toyota, is that he didn't let what happened within his culture, because they were shit on more than one time, he didn't let that, the buck stops and starts with me. He started that family business, taught his son, the family business originally was farming and carpentry. Taught his son carpentry, and his son took it up from there. They manufactured looms also, and then, like I said, his son, Kichiro Toyota, in the family business, and they weren't into manufacturing cars or nothing like that. He started a division within the family company after they got a car. And then broke it down to its component parts and learned that's how they got into the manufacturing business of cars, by that. So I call all of that the ultimate reparations, where they didn't wait on anything outside of their personal sphere. They didn't wait on that. Matter of fact, if they waited on that, they'd still be waiting. So here we have it. Toyota has a multi-million dollar, billion dollar business, or trillions if you count in yen. And like I say, one day we're going to cover, and there's so much to it, we're going to have to break down, because each one of the Toyota heads, really, there's so much information on them. Sakichi, who started the Toyota Group, a group, family group of companies, he's got his, we need to do 2 hours on him. Sakura, who started Toyota Motors within the family business, 2 hours on him. The uncle that was president of Toyota for a number of years, and then the current president who's running Toyota today, Akio Toyota, and that's just one family. All which have a heritage of somewhere down the line, at least culturally speaking, of slavery and repression. They can even say, now you know what, let's get to Katsuro Toyota, who started Toyota Motors. He could have easily said, because at the time that he started Toyota Motors, he could have easily said, well, you know what, the white man started before us, they got a big jump on us, so what's the use? He didn't use that as an excuse. He didn't use the excuse that I don't know how to build a car. He got a car, broke it down, and learned how to build a car that way. Now, you got Toyotas outselling a lot of American name brands. The other person that we're going to cover one day, and I'm just give a brief introduction to him today, and I'll mention him once, was Sachiro Honda. Sachiro Honda used to work for Toyota, and he and another guy got together, and they didn't have no money, so they started what we know today as Honda Motors and all their products that they make. They started off in a wooden shack making bicycle motors. Not motorcycle motors parts, bicycle motors. That's how Sakiro Honda started the whole Honda thing that we know today that takes in billions of dollars. He could have said, well, the white man, they're ahead of us. Henry Ford, he's got us beat. He started before we did. He could have said that, but didn't. And like I stated, he used to work for Toyota. He could have said, well, you know, Toyota, and these guys are pioneers. You know, well, Honda's already out here. You know, they're millionaires. You know, they had the lockdown on the market here in Japan. You know, what's the use? They got a head start. The white American man's got the head start. You know, Henry Ford's got the, you know, the Chrysler brothers got the head start. So you know what? Why even, you know, he didn't think that way. He started off in the shack. So that's what I call ultimate reparations. It looked, once again, reparations. Talk to 1,000 people and ask them to give you a visual on what reparations looks like to them, and you might get 1,000 different answers. But the way I see it is, it's something that you can do for yourself without waiting on exterior forces like the government. You know, some people in the United States are looking for reparations to come from the federal government. Some people, like in Asheville, North Carolina, and Detroit, Michigan, which just passed a reparations bill, and Evanston, I think it's Evanston, Illinois, outside of Chicago. Those are three cities that, well, Detroit and Evanston, they've already passed reparations. So the city of Detroit, they have their version of reparations. okay, that they've gotten together on a local government level, so that's what reparations looks like to them. Evanston, Illinois, they have their version of reparations. That's what it looks like to them. For me, and we've done podcasts on this before, when it comes to descendants of slaves, particularly people that were born slaves, and I've covered this plenty of times on here, you have black folks, that Sarah Rector and her family, they got 160, anywhere from 80 to 160 acres worth of land. Some of it had oil on it. They tapped that oil and became millionaires. That's what, in my opinion, that's what reparations look like for them. Some black folks started their own black townships. That's what reparations look like for those blacks, the founders of like Taft, Oklahoma, Tallahassee, Oklahoma, New Philadelphia, Illinois, Hopkins Park, Illinois, places like that. Highland Beach, Maryland, Fairmont Heights, Maryland, North Brentwood, Maryland. All those are black townships, and that's what reparations for their founders look like to them. So, like I say, talk to a million people. What is reparations? It looks different for everybody. That's why I call it reparations, when you do it yourself. Because once you start looking at outside forces, that's when the excuses come up, and you spin your wheels, and you never get anywhere. This last audio I'm going to play, and I've played this a few times before, is not so much on reparations, but it's something simple, because I believe the universe offers, matter of fact, I believe the universe gives everybody on a regular basis, no matter what kind of physical condition that they might be in, no matter what socioeconomic bracket they might be in, I believe that the universe gives everybody an infinite amount of ideas along with opportunities on how you can become rich, or even a billionaire, if that's what you want to be. I'm going to play this last audio because we can morph this into reparations too, but I'll try to illustrate what I mean.
Also tonight, the incredible transformation and the Buffalo Strong spirit that made it all happen. 7 Eyewitness News reporter Taylor Epps shows us how a young lady has completed her very own renovation project.
11-year-old Lauren Nelson had big plans for her summer.
I thought it was going to be pretty fun, but with COVID going on, it was going to be not as fun as it could be.
But things changed one day when she was flipping through an American Girl doll magazine at her home in Attica.
And she showed us a $650 VW bus. My husband was like, that's ridiculous. You could buy your own camper for that price.
So she did just that. Lauren saved some money and started looking. A neighbor just down the road had this 20-foot camper that caught her eye.
And then the one day, up popped a for sale sign, and she squealed the whole way home,
and she started negotiating.
It wasn't very hard. He said $500, and I said $400 because that was the money that I had in my bank account, and he said sold.
Then it was time to renovate.
It was a process. We brought home a family of mice. And so there was a lot of deep cleaning,
but that didn't stop her.
I was very motivated because I really wanted a place where I could just, like, hang out like my own house.
The whole renovation process took Lauren about 2 months, and with the help of family and friends, she was able to turn this into this.
It's called Camp Hygge. It means very comfortable and safe. It has its own kitchen and bathroom, so it's like a tiny house.
So now you're the owner of a tiny home at 11 years old.
Yes.
The whole project cost her $800.
She has 3 envelopes that she puts her money in, give, save, and spend. I think she made a really good choice. She now says she's part of the Tiny Home Nation.
She was able to turn her summer around and hopes to inspire others to do the same.
Which is awesome to see that somebody who's 11 years old had her own vision but now is out there and other people are contacting us and they've gone out and bought a camper to do the same thing.
If you're looking to have some big plans in the future, you should go out and do it. Make it happen.
In Attica, Taylor Epps, 7 Eyewitness News.
Now, Laura's just 12. She's 12 years old now. As of this date, in July 28th, 2021, Laura's 12 years old right now. That audio was made when she was 11, last year. And let me tie this into generational wealth, the ultimate reparations. Now, her dad recommended that she go do something she did what her father did, asked her to do. Laura, at 11 years old, she probably took some babysitting money. More than likely, she took birthday money at 11. And bought a camper for that needed work. She didn't know nothing about fixing up campers. Needed work. Put $400 of it, like let's say a combination of babysitting money and birthday money, $800 in, okay, good condition. Now, Laura, or anybody who heard that video, or audio rather, can take that same idea, and let's say Laura turned around and sold that camper or other campers that she might get, for $10,000. If she did that, or if you do that, 100,000 times, you'll be a billionaire. Because that's all Toyota did and Honda did. Honda started off in a freaking wooden shack. So there's one for you. An 11, well, like I said, she's 12 now. And there's a whole bunch of people that can afford a $10,000 place to live. Now, let's say, like I said, if she does that or if you do that 100,000 times, you're going to need partners to pull that off. Okay, because that's what and I've said on here before, everything starts with one. But along the way, you're going to have to get some partners. So if Laura or you just act on that simple idea. You know, Toyota, all these guys started off with simple ideas. And that's what I'm saying. The universe gives us everybody on the planet. There's no shortage of ideas, particularly good ideas, mediocre ideas, even bad ideas. There's no shortage of ideas. It's just acting on them. That's your ultimate reparations. Laura didn't wait on Laura's too young to go to social services. But you know what? Laura doesn't ever need to go to social services. Because Laura learned at 11 through hands-on experience on how to provide for herself a debt-free lifestyle, at least for the accommodations that she's going to be sleeping in. Now, she's still with her family and everything. This was her little guest house at the family home. I get that part. But I'm just saying, as Laura grows older, you won't see Laura homeless. And if Laura ever gets to think entrepreneurial, and she might be already, because as you heard her mother state, thanks to YouTube, you have people contacting Laura now, along with her family, mother and father. How'd you do it? And she can take that. Hell, she can, once again, she can partner up 100,000 more times. She's got $1 billion. In any event, let me see if we can get Laura on here one day, too. Along with, there's a black young lady, which I mentioned her a few times. I played her audios in the past. Marie, from Marie TV. If you get a chance, she's a black girl, got pregnant at 15. She and her mother went out and bought a shed and converted the shed into a tiny house for Marie, and Marie participated in that whole process pregnant for her and her son. So she's debt-free. But if you go to Marie TV, that's spelled M-A-R-E-E TV, one word, M-A-R-E-E TV, one word. Go to Marie TV, and she's got a bunch of videos on there, but she's got about three or four on there that tells you how you want to catch the first one on how she did. Pregnant 15-year-old, or was she 16? She was 15 to 16 pregnant and got the shed converted into a tiny house for her and her son, and now she's in college. You won't, that's another one you won't ever see in the social services office. And Marie, black woman, I think Marie might be 19 years old right now, might be. Or she could be 18. 18, 19 years old. She's somewhere in that range. Marie can do the same thing. Do that 100,000 times, which will require partners. She'll be a billionaire. We're going to try to get her on here as well, so you can talk to these people directly. But that's what I call to make reparations. Once again, reparations is a complex topic, and it looks different for everybody. So for those who want to get it through the federal government, good luck. For those of you that might live in Evanston, Illinois, hey, it's there if you qualify. Their version of reparations is there, available to you now. Asheville, North Carolina is working on that. Detroit, they passed their reparations bill. So whatever that, none of it's based on slavery, none of those three. But that's what the people in those locations wanted. They wanted reparations of some type. They came up with their own definition, and they passed the legislation in their local neck of the woods. So that works for them. My version of it is based on what the black townspeople did and what people like Laura's doing, like the Toyota family's doing, like the Honda family's doing. That's where I'm at with it. Now, let me break it down, the common denominator with Laura, Marie TV, Honda, and Toyota. Okay. The common denominator with all four of these people, once again, the Toyota family, the Honda family, Marie TV, and Laura Nelson, is they all made something. I'm going to get to Pleasant Stephens on here, but maybe this week. Because Pleasant Stephens is all about starting your own factory, making something. Marie didn't manufacture anything, and neither did Laura. But there are different distinctions of manufacturing. So that's why I tie that golden cord between Marie, Laura, Honda, and Toyota. That's what Laura, Camp Huey, that's what she's named her little tiny house camper. Man, that can turn to a global manufacturing firm. Anyway, we're going to see if we can get them on here. 336, your mic is open.
Give thanks. Greetings, Brother L.A.
Yes, ma'am.
How are you, sir?
I'm fine.
You've just solidified a major confirmational thing, not thing, but a mission that I'm on. And you've just confirmed some things that the ancestors have been giving me for a long time. And I just happened to tune in. They told me to tune in to you today. I mean, when I say they, I mean the ancestors. Now,
okay.
you mentioned Laura Nelson. Who is Laura Nelson?
That's the white Laura Nelson.
Well, apparently.
But you know what? I'm glad you brought that up, Mama AZ.
Okay,
the Laura Nelson I was talking about today is a little white girl in Attica, New York. But the Laura Nelson I think you're talking about was black, and she was
lynched. My cousin, she was lynched. According to what my family history, the historians told me in my family, we are cousins in Okemo, Oklahoma.
Right.
And it broke my chain because you mentioned Laura Nelson. Apparently, you got to talk about her on your show, and apparently she's in the ethers, and there's a message or something that I need to know concerning Laura Nelson. But I'd like for you to call me, Brother L.A., so we can have a deep reasoning because of the little girl, Laura Nelson. You can't send it to my phone, but can you post her? Does she have a video? Because I tuned in late.
You know what? I'm going to look. Matter of fact, Mama AZ, I'm glad you brought that up. Let me read real quick. I'm going to see if I can find audio because we got some time here. Laura and L.D. Nelson were an African-American mother and son who were lynched on May 25th, 1911.
Yes.
And
yes,
my birthday's May 25th.
And I have it on film. What did you say?
Okay. Near Okemo in Fuscoo County, Oklahoma, they had been seized from their cells in the Okemo County Jail the night before by a group of up to 40 white men, reportedly including Charlie Guthrie, the father of folk singer Woody Guthrie.
That's right. Oh, Brother L.A., I didn't know that was on there. I didn't mean to cut you off, but see, when I went to the bridge where her and her son were lynched, the bridge was down. I have it on film, and when I went to Okemo, I caught them off guard, and they just kind of opened up because they didn't know what the hell this woman, what is she doing walking up in the street and on a walker, you know. And anyhow, to make a long story short, I got some of this on film where they talk about this, and I even went up to the bridge where there's no bridge there, and the author, I met her on the phone of Laura Nelson. It's a book, and the son that the baby, it was a baby, and the people there at the lynching took that baby. It's all on record, and I got the book in somewhere that the author gave me in Boley. She was out of Boley, Oklahoma. So this is deep. This is deep, Brother L.A. So apparently, metaphysically, Laura Nelson must be communicating and had me to call in to you today to hear that, to trigger that. We need to talk. Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Well, it's interesting. Laura Nelson.
And by the way, the Caucasian people that took Laura's son raised that son. It's all in the book.
Let me see. Laura Nelson, her and her son were lynched on May 25th. I was born on May 24th. Her son went by L.D. Nelson. I got initials L.D. Now, do you know what kind of What kind of work did she, you know anything about her, you know, livelihood or anything back then?
All I know is when I got the book Without Sanctuary, the elder who's crossed over, John, he was a congressman out of Georgia. You know who I'm talking about. Lewis, I think it is. I got the book. It's in storage. Mm. Well, when I found out, when Sunny Man, my cousin, told me that Laurel was a family member, I decided to make up 12 shirts. But I had to call to Atlanta, Georgia, to the, Lewis's office, because he's a part of that book, to get permission to make 12 shirts for my family. And they had a fit. My family did. Why are you so obsessed with death? Anyway, I didn't know. All I know is when I got that book and I started going through that book, Laura Nelson jumped out at me off of that page. I swear to God. And I, my cousin Sonny Man, he was on the planet at that time. And I called him and I said, Sonny Man, I said, what's up with this? Who, can you tell me about Laura Nelson, the lynching? And then he went off. He told me, he said, Kunan, she's in the family. I've been telling your crazy ass, you don't listen to the history. Your daddy wants you to come and get on the rolls in there in Oklahoma, and you think he's bullshit, but he wasn't. And he says, there's a lot of history here in this Paris and Crawford family. So Laura Nelson is related to us. And I'm not surprised she jumped out at you off of that book, because it's something that you got to do, put man. So what I did, I rented a car and took a journey. And I got part of it on film, me being in Okemah. I'm not kidding you, Brother L.A. And the thing is, I got about 2,000 films of my history, documentation of all of that, and it being everywhere, even at the teepee, you know, in Napoleon Davis's teepee. And I swear, it's the reason that you are a Davis. Even now, Napoleon is calling out. I got a long haul with this issue that I'm having, because the titanium ate up a lot of my bone, and I'm taking infection medicine to get the infection away. I got to go to the disease control doctor tomorrow so they can see where my levels are so I can get open back up again. And he told me it'd be a year or more before I even heal it. And he's not promising anything. He told me this yesterday. But hey, he's human. He miracles do happen. But the point being is, you've sparked an interest. You've reopened up something that I went to Oklahoma. My people brought me there, and you are a major part of this, Brother L.A., even with that teepee. I mean, I don't think you even realize how symbolic it is, and I thank you for listening and following, at least to get some land intact. Because, Brother
well, you
LA,
know, that teepee that you're talking about, and people I got to post it again. It's the teepee she's talking about was built by a Napoleon Davis.
Yes.
He built that all by himself. In my opinion, that teepee should be at the Smithsonian. What's that? The museum that they opened up in D.C. of African American history. In my opinion, that's where that teepee needs to be. But what's interesting, a lot of people don't even know that teepee exists. And I'm talking about people that live in
right there.
Nearby towns, no more than 20 minutes away from that location in
that's right.
Muskogee.
They live in the backyard or the front yard or whatever of that teepee, and they don't even have a freaking clue. But let me tell you something. When I went in 2006, they gave me a Cadillac. Enterprise gave me a Cadillac. I have all of that on film, a car. And I stayed, 4 months researching there in Pawhuska, Ahoskie, or whatever, the reservation courthouse, or whatever, with my people. And when I went up to that teepee, how I got to that teepee, listen to this, family. Joanne Fox was the mayor of that township there, and
what city?
In Oklahoma, it's one of the black townships.
No, what town in Oklahoma was she the mayor of?
Okay, wait a minute. Look up Joanne Fox way back in the day, and they ousted her because she and Bellsville some funds, and when I came there, I had a CB antenna on the back, and it was my CB radio, and I had asked so many questions. Her mom tried to get my ass ran out of that little town. I think it was Bowie, or I don't remember, Brother L.A., but you do. You can find it and jar my memory. Joanne Fox. See, Joanne was connected to the mayor in North Carolina. They were friends, two women. The little town going to Manio, North Carolina, you go through this little town. Her dad, I can't remember, I have it on film, her dad was the mayor in North Carolina of this little bitty town. It may have been Princeville. I don't know. I don't remember, but I have it on film. And then when her dad, the woman who was mayor in North Carolina in this little town, when her dad made his transition, she took his seat. And come to find out, her and Joanne Fox were friends.
Mama AZ, I got an audio about the Laura Nelson you're talking about. Let me play it real quick. Hold on.
Did you ever see a hangman tie a hangknot? Did you ever see a hangman tie a hangknot? I've seen it many a time, and he whines and he whines. After 13 times he's got a hangknot. Tell me, will that hangknot slip? No, it will not. Will that hangknot slip? No, it will not. Slip around your neck, but it won't slip back again. Hang not, hang not, that hang not.
Well, I am here in Okemah County, Oklahoma. I'm about 6 miles west of a little old oil boom town known as Okemah. And I am standing below what was once known as the old Schoolton Bridge. It's now Highway 56, and of course this isn't the same bridge, but a very tragic incident took place here back in 1911. This was the site of a double lynching of a woman named Laura Nelson and her 14-year-old son, L.D., who were brought out here and lynched. Now, just to give you a little bit of a background on this, Oklahoma reached statehood a few years earlier in 1907. There weren't that many black people out here at that time, up until this time. So prior to statehood, the lynchings that did take place around these parts were usually of white men who were cattle rustlers and robbers and thieves, highwaymen. But when Oklahoma gained statehood in 1907, along with the Constitution, it embraced those Jim Crow laws that came after in the post-slavery years. And so most of the lynchings that took place after that were of black people, and there was some sort of a political statement behind them. Now, as the story goes, the father of the Nelson family, Austin Nelson, he stole a cow from a local farmer. And so the deputy sheriff out of Okemah, he and a couple of his men went to the Nelson home to serve an arrest warrant. And while they were there, Austin's wife, Laura, and their 14-year-old son, LD, armed themselves. And in the outcome, the deputy sheriff was shot and killed. And there's different claims as to exactly what happened. Most claims are that LD shot the deputy, but it was an accidental shooting after a struggle with a gun. Now, either the struggle was with Deputy Loney, or some say it was with his mother, Laura, who was trying to take the gun away from him. It was a Winchester rifle. But either way, Deputy Loney was shot and killed. Laura, some say, she claimed that she shot him just to take the rap and protect her son. But Deputy Loney and his men retreated outside, and he was shot in the leg, and that's where he bled to death. The newspaper report claimed that while he was bleeding to death, he had begged for water from Mrs. Nelson, and she responded by saying, quote, "let the white blank die," is how it was printed in the paper. Of course, those are the accounts from the white posse who was there. But they were eventually captured and taken into Okemah, where they were housed in the jails there, and we'll head into town now and take a look at that. So here in Okemah, this is where the Nelson family was brought when they were arrested. Behind me here, this is what was once the county jail, and this is where the son, L.D. Nelson, was held. Now, the father, Austin Nelson, he fully cooperated the whole time, and he immediately pleaded guilty to larceny charges, and so they shipped him out about 60 miles away to McAllister, to the prison, and he served a 3-year prison sentence there. Now, while L.D. was housed here in the county jail, his mom, Laura, was held in a jail cell over at the courthouse. Now, the Nelson family was jailed here in town for about 3 weeks, up until the night before their scheduled court arraignment, when the justice system would run its course. And on that night, close to midnight on May the 24th, a lynch mob posse busted in here, and according to the jail guard, a man named W.L. Payne, they, at gunpoint, tied him up, bound him, gagged him, cut the phone lines, took his keys, and grabbed L.D. and hauled him out of here. Now behind me is the Okefuski County Courthouse, and the top floor is the jails, and this is where Laura Nelson was housed while she was awaiting arraignment. So after the lynch mob kidnapped her son LD from the county jail around the corner where we were just at, they then marched down here and did the same with Laura and grabbed them both and took them out to the old Schoolton Bridge, where we will now return.
Now the next scene is down by the river. Heartbroken mother and babe in the harbor light glare, see them shiver. Outcast that no one will save. Once she was a true woman, somebody's darling and pride. God help her, she leaps. There's no one to weep at the picture from life's other side.
Now, this lynching took place around midnight. The following morning, when the bodies were discovered hanging here, word quickly spread, and a large group of the town folks came out here. Now, get this. They lined up across, this isn't the same bridge, obviously, but they lined up across the bridge with the two corpses hanging below them and posed for photos. Okemah had one studio photographer there, a professional photographer, who came out and got in a boat out here and took this big group photo. I'll never understand that mentality, but I know that there were a lot of lynching photos taken, and the fact that people can stand next to the corpses that they just killed, and very proudly, and if you see these pictures, they obviously had no fear at that time that they were going to get picked out of the photo and prosecuted. But that was a thing, a common thing to do. They would take pictures of the corpses and take group photos. And while he was at it, he took a couple of close-up photos of the corpses, and those photos were made into souvenir postcards and sold in the local stores. It's been said that the photo of Laura Nelson's lynching is the only known photo that exists of a female lynching victim, although they must be referring to the only individual photo, because I know I have seen the Mary Surratt photos of the Lincoln assassination conspiracy. She was a part of that hanging. Now, believe it or not, making souvenir postcards out of photos from lynch victims was fairly common back in those days. And I think in this case, it served as a warning to other black people around here that If you come around here and you cause trouble, this will happen to you. As a matter of fact, there's a nearby town called Boley, and it always was and still is an all-black community. And it's been thought that that's the reason why they made these postcards, was to warn the people of Boley. Actually, the day after all this happened, the town of Okemah was in a general panic. They feared that they were going to receive retribution from the town folks of Boley. And so a lot of the women and children, they camped them out in the fields for a couple of nights while the men stood guard along Main Street. Now, maybe I can understand using these photos as a warning, but I'll never understand why, as postcards, they would make them for people to send to their friends and family. There's this social behavior from the past that maybe I'll never understand. Now, there are some unconfirmed reports from witnesses on the scene. Some witnesses claim that Laura Nelson was raped by members of the posse. And another story that went around was that Laura Nelson also had with her a baby daughter named Carrie, who she had with her the entire time that she was in jail, and that when they were taken to the bridge, it's been said that she laid the baby down at the foot of the bridge before being marched out to the waiting noose. And after she was hanged, the lynch mob posse just all walked away and abandoned the baby. But someone did come by shortly after and rescue the baby and raised her as her own. And so if the baby story is true, then all I can say is thank God at least there was some humanity there. Now, this whole tragic event more than likely would have been forgotten in history and time not long after the postcards went out of circulation if it weren't for one Okemah native son who actually wasn't born until the year after this tragedy took place. Okemah is the boyhood home of Woody Guthrie.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Now, Woody's father, Charlie Guthrie, he was a local politician here and the county clerk, and it is strongly believed that Woody's father, Charlie, was among the lynch mob that took the Nelson family out and lynched them. And it's also believed that he is among the spectators that appears in the group photo standing over the bridge. Now, Woody, while he was growing up here, he saw those souvenir lynching postcards on display in the local stores here, and he also heard his father talk about this incident from time to time. So growing up and seeing these photos and hearing the stories, it obviously had a very profound effect upon him. Woody is known as the most prolific songwriter that America ever produced. They say he wrote over 3,000 songs, and some of the songs that he wrote was about this tragedy that he heard about and saw the photos of while growing up. Now, the fact that Woody was considered a communist, the town of Okemah shunned him for many, many years. The first time I came through here in the mid-80s, I came here to research Woody, and I was expecting to see T-shirts and all kinds of memorabilia. Nothing. And when I would ask about Woody, the people around here at that time were saying, we don't talk about him around here. So he was a forgotten son for many years. However, in recent years, more liberal-minded people have taken to the council seats and so forth, and now they embrace Woody as their native son. They have a big festival here every year. They created this little park here in memory of him, put this little statue up, and during the fundraising drive, people could pay money to have their names put on these little bricks that you see around here and have the title of one of Woody's songs or other things saying. And I just discovered somebody donated one over here, if we'll take a look at that, and that tells our story. Now, besides this being the county jail, this building also has some other local historic reference. Woody Guthrie, now in his popular autobiography, Bound for Glory, in which most of the book was about his upbringing here in Okemah, he did write in there somewhere I read where he said he went around and he carved his initials and his name in every fence post and every signpost, everywhere that he could carve his name and his initials. He did. And of all that, there is still one relic of Woody that still exists here, and it's right at the same spot, ironically, right over here, if you take a look in the corner here. As you can see, Woody dated his signature in 1927. He was 15 years old at that time, and it was just shortly before he moved out of this community and went to Pampa, Texas. Well, I'd like to close with some lyrics by Woody that he wrote from a song called High Balladry. This is one of the songs that he wrote about this particular incident. A nickel postcard I buy off your rack to show you what happens if you're black and fight back. A lady and two boys hanging by their necks from the rusty iron rigs of my Canadian bridge.
Tell me who makes the laws for that hangnut? Who makes the laws for that hangnut? Who says who will go to the calaboose, get the hangman's noose or the hangnut? I don't know who makes the law for that hangnut. I don't know who makes the law for that hangnut. But the bones of many a man are whistling in the wind just because they tied their laws with a hangnut.
All right, that's a little bit backstory on the black Laura Nelson who got lynched in Oklahoma. I got a feeling to really get another point of view on what possibly could have happened, including a more actual or factual backstory, because from the little bit I've read online, is her and her husband, they had a farm. So how big the farm was, I don't know, but they had a farm. And what happened now, he was accused, her husband was accused of stealing a cow. And he pleaded guilty to that immediately, and he did some prison time behind it. But I got to get more understanding on why a search warrant was being executed at the home. The son, L.D. or L.W. So we'll cover that more one day. Anyway, my Maisie, hold it. Hold it, Pionk. I'm going to come to you in a moment. My Maisie, any other comments on that?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God, Brother L.A., can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, my God. Brother L.A., can you find a way to come here? I tell you, I know that Laura Nelson and Sonny Man and my people over there, if Bowley is where the author comes from. Anyway, it's just too much information to share on your show, but I want to say, golly, I mean, Brother L.A., you got to listen. You please, because I didn't go through this for nothing. It's so much that I need to share with you, sir, and please help me resurrect the let's go to the story. I got this on film. I've been begging people to look for a VHS camera or a converter or something that I can convert. I'm telling you, I got a lot of footage. I got two big giant
Okemo County and Oswego County.
Yes.
Okay.
Laura Nelson brought me there through spirit, and my cousin Sonny Man said.
When you were there, did you get a chance to locate where they used to live? Because they did have a farm.
No, I didn't. But let's do that. You got that spot in Taft. I'm not sure what's going to happen with the next major surgery. I don't know anything. All I know is it's serious with my body, and I'm in prayer. So what I'm saying to you, Brother L.A., I want to get my ducks in a row just in case something happens. Meaning, mm-hmm. I cross over. And this bullshit, no, you ain't going to, you got, now, I don't know that because mm-hmm. they're pumping me with a whole lot of infectious drugs, and disease control people, I get this pump through my veins every fucking 8 hours, and it makes me crazy. However,
when you went there, was that bridge still there?
No, I said that. I have it on.
Okay.
It's not there. And the interesting thing about it, when I got up to where you go off down in the woods, my camera stopped. It just stopped. But I got enough to prove that I'm there. And then I got people on there. It's on a VHS camera and a camcorder, you see. And we gotta convert this, Brother L.A. It has to be, and it's my house and Soul Purpose Healing, the Blog Talk family, because my goddamn family, they don't give a shit about me. They don't think of the history, and when I have dreams, and my people from Oklahoma communicate with me, just like Laura had me to tune in. And Sunny Man, and I want this to go on record. If any of my people, which are stupid asses, if you ever take the time to listen to this, like my dad, Bob Paris, he said there's a lot of land that is still there in Oklahoma when we had 300 acres of land. I researched this shit when I was there. That's how the teepee, when I said Joanne Fox, how I got there was through a dream. Chief Frank Fullscrow, my dad, and Black Elk guided me there. And then I met Joanne Fox when she thought I was the FBI. I didn't know at the time that the questions that I was asking, it frightened her. And so her mom called Enterprise and checked up on me and tried to get my black ass to get out of Dodge. And then later on, I found out that she got ousted, Joanne Fox got ousted because of the monies that she took from being mayor. This is a true story. I even have her mom on film bitching at me to get the hell on off of their land, off of their property. I'm not lying. And you need to know this. The family needs to know this. Something is getting ready to happen. Family, there is land in Oklahoma. I don't have the energy or the knowledge to research. All I know is, Brother L.A., your name is Davis, and the ancestors guided me to the Napoleon Davis teepee, and they on the sign now, it even has the name. And one other thing that I want to say, Payne, that's my husband, in North Carolina, who has another wife. I have a sister wife, Payne. When I saw that sign, it's a pain that was running for mayor there in that community, okay? And I knew then that the ancestors had hooked me up to be there to investigate. So I don't doubt my cousin, Sunny Man, saying that Laura Nelson is our cousin. I don't doubt it. Because she damn sure did jump off the page out of that book. And then not only that, I went to the library there in Okemah, and they gave me all kinds of information, even the dress that Laura Nelson was hung in. Listen to me, people. It's in the Smithsonian. It's in the Smithsonian. And all of that information that the library gave me, it disappeared. And then when I went back to get it again, they didn't even want to talk to me. This is in Okemah, Oklahoma. And the last thing that I want to say is, wake up, family. You have land there. Wake up and investigate. And Napoleon Davis, one other thing that I want to say, he was not from this planet. He was not, because the little bit that he had left on that teepee, the way the schematic, the way that it was like, it is straight out of a fucking time machine, y'all. I saw this. I have this on film. Other people from other worlds guided Napoleon Davis and Mama Bonfire. Robert Lee Paris is my birth given name. I'm saying that. Other people from other worlds guided Napoleon Davis to do that, because what I saw is no longer there. It blew me away. It was like a time machine, the way he put things on the building and everything. So I'll be quiet. Brother L.A., you got to come here, because I don't want to leave the planet with the information that the universe, the creator, and you're right about the universe. We have things that we can do. However, people feel they don't give a shit about me, and I'm grateful that I'm able to, at 70, going on 70, that no matter what has happened to me, I'm still a little bit where I can speak up and speak out, because family, some things are going to change. It's going to be switched around. Esoterically, you better get your shit together, and especially Melanation Station, Indigenous people, and especially them ones up there in that goddamn church who still locked down with the bullshit and the lies. It's going to get real, people. And if you don't know how to survive out there on the Overground Railroad, meaning in the wilderness and on the earth, on the land, just like right now, I'm in a facility, mm-hmm. and there's no hot water. However, my family snuck me a Coleman stove. I have rheumatoid arthritis, and I need hot water sometimes to get the pain to settle down sometimes. I got my little Coleman stove and my pot, and it's a whole bunch of other things that if you don't know, your ass is going to be grass. And I'm grateful that I know as much, and I learned this from the reservation in Oklahoma, especially my dad, Bob Paris. See why I came to him and my mom, because my people were no joke, and I see that now. I see that as far as survival is concerned. So I can go on, but Brother L.A., see if you can connect with me. Because you got
it. Okay, I sure will.
And see, Napoleon Davis, it doesn't need to be in the Smithsonian. He created that because right there in Muskogee, because of a vortex. If that TP is moved or taken down, that shifts the whole atmosphere over there. It does. I know, because when I went there in 2006, unbelievable. I had seen it in a dream, and I couldn't believe it when I drove up there. Even the cows were at attention. Like they were saluting me. What the hell took you so long, Mama Bonfire? I swear to God, I have that on film. I'll be quiet.
Okay. All right. I'll be in touch with you real soon. And on that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.